This is BSD.
Hello, I'm Gianluca Baroni.
And I'm Chris Stevenson.
And welcome to the Media Weekly podcast from PhD, where we break down the media news agenda, making some leaps into what it all means for marketing and communications. How are you, Chris?
I'm doing good, thanks, Gianluca, in what has been, well, quite a momentous week, and with the sad passing of Queen Elizabeth II, a huge event in and of its own right, of course, but also one with significant implications for marketers, with the vast majority of advertising being suspended as a mark of respect. So agencies like ourselves have been working closely with clients and media partners all throughout the last week.
Absolutely. It's been a very complex and delicate time period, and we're working closely with our clients to navigate that.
And certainly for anyone listening at PhD, a big thank you for taking the necessary steps with all of our clients and partners, wherever you are around the world and however you've been affected by the news of the last few days. There's been some other news, of course, in the marketing world. And to give us a handle on that, Pollyanna's back, right, Gianluca?
Absolutely. So Pollyanna's back on the show. Hopefully you've all heard her before, talking about all things social. And we've had such a brilliant response to her content that we've decided to dedicate a weekly fixture on the podcast where Pollyanna runs us through the top headlines in the Media Weekly news.
Hi everyone, Pollyanna Ward here, and I'll be sharing the latest news from the advertising industry, which I hope will spark some engaging conversations around the coffee machine in your office this week. First of all, I feel like I could not do this week's segment without calling out the It's Corn kid who rose to fame on TikTok a couple of weeks ago after an interview with a great little kid called Tarek. I believe he's from New York. He was interviewed for a local news segment. Basically passionately shared his love for corn, or sweet corn as we call it here in the UK, but yeah, corn on the cob. He absolutely loved it, and somebody then put his interview to backing music, remixed it slightly, and the sound just went absolutely nuts on TikTok to the tune of millions of views. And now in the last week, Chipotle have tapped into this cultural zeitgeist moment to be relevant by taking Tarek of It's Corn viral fame and putting their own spin on it. So in the video that they posted on their Instagram as a reel last week, you can see a Chipotle member of staff over the counter of Chipotle where they are asking a customer whether they'd like rice or black beans or salsa. And you can just repeatedly hear the customer consistently answering no. But then the server gets to any corn and the video pans up to Tarek, who is, of course, the huge viral sensation from TikTok, who shouts, "It's corn." And of course, he absolutely wants corn on his Chipotle burrito. Now, finding the sweet spot like this, I feel, has a bit of a formula. So you take what the people are talking about, you build on it through your brand lens in a way that's still relevant to you, and then you amplify it across channels to achieve scale. In this instance, you have It's Corn and a brand that provides corn in their burrito bowls, and it's currently sitting at 33 million videos. So if you do want to go and check it out, head to their Instagram page. But I think the wider learning here is that it just goes to show that you can copy memes. Of course you can. We've seen so many videos of brands doing very generic copies of the video where they just change the song lyrics or the text overlay to be It's Books or It's Cucumber or It's Face Cream. But actually, you just end up becoming part of the noise. And what I think is really important for brands to take away from this is that to drive standout, if you are going to be reactive and you are going to respond to trends as they happen in real time, you really want to aim for that point of difference. You know, give people something fresh and new to watch to match their social behavior. So I do wonder if there's more to this partnership to come. Now, my second story, it's a bit of a wild card story, but do you know where memes come from? Know Your Meme, which is an incredibly niche online website, which essentially you can go on and research memes and find out where they came from and who started it and any future iterations. They've released a graph that shows the origin of memes by platforms over time. And there's a few interesting things I wanted to take from this. Firstly, TikTok now accounts for 30% of meme origin now, compared to just 10% in 2020. And interestingly, YouTube in 2011 was responsible for 40% of memes that would make their way around the internet, but it only accounts for around 10 to 15%. And the other channel that really did stand out to me is Twitter's absolute reign at being the meme origin king or queen for the last 10 years. I mean, Twitter has always inherently had a bit of a remix or reiterate format. You know, you've always had the ability to quote tweet or retweet and add comments underneath. And I think this is a helpful little insight into how memes are formed. And I'd kind of argue that as we start to see more niche, smaller, closed social apps grow, such as BeReal or Paparazzi, there's possibly an argument to say that we might not get as many memes. That actually memes need a large audience who are aware of the cultural context of said meme in order to remain relevant, because that's how they stick around, right? You know, they transcend generations, interest groups, channels, because their source material is able to be tweaked and built upon. But ultimately, I do think the key takeout from this graph is really the power that TikTok has. In just 2 years, to be up there, ready to take Twitter off the top spot and beating out channels such as Facebook, Instagram, and Reddit in a matter of 2 years is quite a feat. So I'm very keen to see this graph again in a few years' time. And I wanted to just finish off this segment. I did just want to mention, you know, that whilst there's been lots of exciting and interesting stories this week, it's really important that we acknowledge the news of the passing of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth. Brands the world over paused their advertising activity as a mark of respect, and some left tributes on their social pages. And one of the most poignant of these was Paddington Bear's Twitter post. For the Jubilee earlier this year, Paddington actually sat down for tea and marmalade sandwiches with the Queen in a very special piece of content that has been seen by millions. And to mark the passing last week, Paddington once again shared an illustration of the Queen and Paddington together. That's all from me today. And I'm going to hand you back now to Chris and Gianluca. Thank you.
A big thank you to Pollyanna Ward there for getting us up to speed with the week's media news. And of course, let's touch on that last point that she made in the last item, which is the passing of Queen Elizabeth II and that brilliant Paddington bit of content that she created not too long ago. And she really was just incredible at media and communication. And I suppose it was really only in the later part of her life that we saw examples of that, most recently with Paddington. But probably my highlight, which was that amazing part of the London Olympics opening ceremony, where I think like many millions of people around the world, we couldn't quite believe it when she turned around and it was actually her talking to James Bond. What an amazing moment that was.
Absolutely. I think the attention of the media is now turning to celebrating the life story of the Queen and not least her humor.
Yeah, I mean, she really had an incredible deft touch. It's one of the things that a lot of the media are talking about, and not just a deft touch with her great sense of humor, which has been talked a lot about over the last few days, but a great touch with media and changing media. Her coronation, which took place in 1953, was for many people the first time they'd seen TV in colour. And the sad news that broke last Thursday, a lot of that initially travelled on Twitter. So we've just seen these huge changes in media over the course of her reign, over the course of her life. And we've seen incredibly deft use of that media throughout her reign as well.
Absolutely. She was undoubtedly a cultural icon and she'll be missed.
Coming up next is our conversation with some of the great and good and PhD on Challenger thinking. Joining us now on this week's podcast, we've got a range of the great and the good from PhD. We're talking Challenger Thinking off the back of last week's Mavericks and Mischief Makers event by Contagious. A few of us were there in London. The event celebrated the entertainers, the zaggers, the mavericks, the mischief makers, all those people and brands who've left field ideas and right brain creativity connect with customers in a really often humorous way. It was a great event and we've got the team on the cast to talk about it, and we'll hear from Malcolm Devoy a bit later on. For now, we've got George, Claire and Mandy. Thanks all very much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Brilliant stuff. Mandy, let me go to you first. Tell us a bit about the event and what you made of it all.
Yeah, so as you say, it was an event hosted by Contagious. I thought it was I thought it was great. I thought it was really inspiring. It felt really timely as we're kind of in this period where the overall mood isn't particularly optimistic. So it was pretty refreshing, really, to kind of take a step back and have a think about campaigns and strategies that help lighten the mood. I don't think we always really do that. And I think when you often ask someone about their favourite ads, they kind of tend to be those kind of funny ads that are memorable. They're generally pretty entertaining. So we kind of know as an industry that humour and fame is really important, but I'd probably say that we don't action it enough. And I think another thing that I thought of when I was in the session was around emotion. And there was a guy from Ipsos that was quite interesting talking about, you know, the effects of this type of advertising. And when we think of emotion driving comms as being really important, we don't tend to think of humour. We tend to think of ads and comms that kind of pull at the heartstrings. So again, I thought that was like a really interesting take out from the session. But yeah, overall, I think really refreshing, because it was quite interesting as we, you know, they talked a lot about anti-purpose, and obviously everyone is doing these wonderful ads that are, you know, talking about, you know, purpose and good work and everything. But this was the flip side of that, which I think is equally good.
Yeah, it was absolutely that sense on fun and especially humour in a way that perhaps we don't really use enough at the moment. George, let me go to you. What was your take out on the event?
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, I really enjoyed the event too, just like Mandy. I've been a fan of Contagious for a while and went to their Metaverse event back in April, which was also a really, really good morning. I think why I like Contagious and their events more broadly, they saw this at back in April and at the Mavericks event, was how they really inspire creative and outside-the-box thinking. And I think that can be applied to agencies and to brands in a really kind of balanced way. It brings a lightheartedness to our industry as well. As Mandy said, they use like short case study videos well, which I think lightens the mood more, keeps everyone engaged. And for me, it was quite good networking as well at the event. being new to the industry, I think it's a great chance to meet people across the industry. And yeah, it brings together a really good range of agency and brand speakers. And I think with a real focus on disruption.
And Claire, you came down from Manchester for the event as well, right?
I did, Chris, I did. For me, it was an absolutely brilliant day. And as you know, just building on what George and Mandy have said before, just really, really timely. But for me, what I took from it was this fast-paced, high-energy take on the rebels of the industry past and present, people who really stick up for what they believe in. A couple of votes really stand out for me. So an Argentinian, Jorge Heyman, who famously built a bridge to connect a housing development to Buenos Aires to the city, rather than actually like campaign himself, to tell everyone about it. He thought that was best to get people to come and visit the housing development rather than an ad campaign. So that really stood out to me. But also people and brands who take a stand against conformity and being boring. So Liquid Death, the water company, completely smashing water conventions. And what I took from that is that established brands, people and platforms get to the top by not playing by the rules. And that was a key takeout for me. And also, just to say what everyone's been talking about as well, this was a real reminder to me that we work in the best industry and to have fun, and the best work happens when we're all having fun and bringing some humour into what we do.
It's a brilliant assessment. I think that point you made around just breaking category conventions, we talk a lot around break conventions, break the rules, and the way that you get cut through is to challenge some of those. And it's easily said, but it's not as easily done, right? And I think I got that sense in the morning. It does take genuine bravery sometimes to zig what other people are zagging, right?
And I think, what was it, Emily Ross from Twitter said, it was just the right amount of evil. And she gave us a number of different tactics about how to do that. And I thought some of those really resonated with me.
I thought one of the genius examples that they talked about in the session was the Vienna Museum's OnlyFans, which I hadn't actually heard of. But I thought that was just a great example of bravery. So for anyone that isn't aware of that, just go and Google it. But the crux of it is that there's quite a lot of kind of art out there that is, you know, salacious, essentially. They basically wanted to promote the museum on social platforms, and because of some of the kind of safety measures in place, they can't advertise some of those images and some of the artwork. And so they actually created an OnlyFans site, and there was a lot of PR around that. But I just thought that was just a brilliant example of kind of breaking convention there. So go and have a Google, and they got loads of PR out the back of that.
I loved the term that they used to describe that execution. Was it optimal convergence? So the right amount of unexpected. I just think that's a lovely phrase that we could take forward thinking about how to disrupt categories. It's that optimal amount of convergence where OnlyFans and Vienna Art Museum did really well. Or is it high art, low culture? Yeah, that's brilliant.
Another session I thought was brilliant, which is unsurprisingly Andy Nairn's one. So he's the founder of Lucky Generals, and I think everyone probably enjoyed that session. But I thought it was quite interesting. Obviously, humour, Lucky Generals are known for their, you know, funny campaigns and stuff. But I thought it was quite interesting where he said that he talked about humour like ticking quite a lot of boxes that you probably wouldn't anticipate they would. So obviously, you know, the obvious, like making brands famous and making brands more likeable. But the fact that humour can make brands actually purposeful, they can help kind of diffuse difficult topics or situations and kind of lighten the mood in what potentially is tougher times. So like the Yorkshire tea example with the social distancing teapot, I think is again just a brilliant execution and is an example of where a lot of brands were kind of going down the kind of pulling on the heartstrings, we're here for you throughout the pandemic, and they went and took the opposite route to kind of brilliant effect. So yeah, I thought his talk in particular was standout for me.
And it was really interesting when Andy was talking about that to hear the discussion that went behind it. They were kind of actually, is this the right time to talk about humor post-pandemic? And it's important that brands do this, but do it with the eyes wide open and do it responsibly, right? And Malcolm, this is probably a good time to bring you in. I mean, it must be music to your ears, being such a big champion of challenger thinking, not just in PhD, in the industry. It must be great for you to hear these kind of conversations surfacing at industry events, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, probably my two favorite topics. One is challenger behaviors. The other is the attention economy. And they really seem to be converging together in this. So, you know, everything that we've learned about attention recently is that you need to drive attention. You know, a disproportionate amount of attention drives a disproportionate amount of recall and salience, and therefore a disproportionate amount of return. So combining attention with treading a path not taken by the rest of the category really creates that standout. And just hearing all of these stories from that event makes me think of this phrase that I've used before when it comes to advertising in general, which is, we're not in the persuasion industry. We're in the entertainment industry. And I think, you know, all the stories that we've heard so far really highlights that. And I think, you know, we all know that people don't necessarily trust advertising. It's not going to be successful if we're trying to be persuasive, because people don't go to ads to get persuaded. They go to their friends or get validation in other methods. But what advertising can be brilliant at is playing a role in entertainment. And whether that is humour or controversy or compassion, we can't forget that that's the role that advertisers need to play. And that goes for all categories. It doesn't just have to be the ones with a legitimate claim to be in the entertainment category. It can be in finance. It can be in toothpaste. It can be in insurance, for all we know.
And I think that's exactly right. And I thought Andy Nairn, when he was talking about it in the session, really landed that point that it can work across a whole range of categories. George, you were nodding along when Mandy was talking about that session. It seemed like it resonated for you, right?
Yeah, I really enjoyed Andy as well. I thought he came across very modestly as well, but he mentioned how he talked about the Super Bowl ad as another example where they have seen great results on one of the most prized advertising spots there is. And yeah, I've really enjoyed hearing him talk about that. And Lucky Generals, I've heard talked about on other podcasts as well as a really exciting agency.
And I think what Andy's session in particular did for me when I came out of it was thinking, actually, it was a bit of a stark reminder that we spend too much time focusing on how tech or a platform works. And actually, if we spend a bit more time focusing on how the human mind works, and we're understanding that, we can create really, really good, persuasive, entertaining content, understanding how that human mind works rather than the platform itself.
You're listening to the Media Weekly podcast from PhD. We're talking challenger thinking. We'll be right back after this.
Marketing today can be pretty complicated. Advancements in data and technology have radically reorganized the world for marketers. As an industry, we need to get ahead of the rapid change and stop just responding to it. To think longer term, to start building the future today. Introducing Shift, a new book which brings together the opinions of leaders across the world of marketing communications, plus exclusive research to help marketers and their agencies rethink marketing for tomorrow, today. To find out more and buy the book, visit shiftbyphd.com. That's shiftbyphd.com.
Welcome back. We're talking challenger thinking and disruptive marketing. PhD have covered these topics for years. In fact, we've published two books on them, Overthrow 1 and more recently Overthrow 2, which details the strategies that a new wave of challenger brands has adopted. For anyone who doesn't know, Malcolm, could you tell us a bit more about how the book came about and what it covers?
So Overthrow, the original one, was written in 2012. It came about through a collaboration between Adam Morgan of Eat Big Fish and PhD. I was lucky enough to be involved in that project. And Adam brought a tremendous amount of challenger thinking, obviously his entire previous 20 years since he launched the book, Eating the Big Fish, has been evolving around challenger behaviours. And the reason why we wanted to update it in 2019 was because of the new breed of challengers and the new tactics and behaviours that they're exhibiting to really show how challenger behaviours can create remarkably different effects, both for their own business, but also within society as well, and the way that we expect brands to behave.
So to help bring this to life, why don't we dive into an example of a challenger type in more detail? So one of the speakers at the event was John Schoolcraft, Global Chief Creative Officer at Oatly. And in Overthrow 2, Oatly was categorized as a next generation challenger brand. Could you tell us a bit more about how Oatly fits into this challenger type?
I really think Oatly is one of the definitive examples of a next generation brand. So we interviewed John Schoolcraft as part of writing Overthrow 2. And some of the things that really emerged from it that have ultimately ladded up to some principles that we would put behind all challenger brands. One of them is that he is absolutely focused on drawing attention by mass audiences. So something he talked about is out of home being their primary media channel after their packaging itself, because they want to demonstrate the confidence in their own product. And in order to do that, they want to be in the big spaces. So he directly compares that with, you know, private messaging through social media channels. And he says he always wants to be in those big spaces. But when it comes to that next generation narrative, they've been so good at it. What we mean by that when we talk about it in Overthrow 2 is a brand that consciously sets up all other brands within the category on the side of history that's gone by. So it's as if to say, there was a day, there was a time for certain behaviours and products, but there is a new day and new times call for new brands and so on. And Oatly have done this absolutely brilliantly. I mean, all of their marketing activity in recent years has been focused on creating that identity of a next generation brand. And if I can just kind of go back in time with them, when Oatly originally launched, they were essentially, you know, an oat milk drink for those people that were lactose intolerant. You know, it was a solution to a problem for a small number of buyers. But of course, they shifted that ingeniously with this idea of a post-milk generation, appealing to a much larger audience and creating the kind of attention that came with campaigns like It's Like Milk But Made for Humans. You know, a game-changing creative idea that they employed. And it really did set the milk industry as part of the old and Oatly as very much part of the new.
So this actually really reminds me of the debate that we were having on the podcast last week, you know, between the two camps around, you know, building mental and physical availability and speaking to the category consistently being of utmost importance, perhaps much more than driving attention and being particularly creative. Where do you stand on that debate, Malcolm?
When it comes to attention, I think the big debate raging at the moment is how much attention matters, with two polarizing views. I think, you know, unquestionably you need attention. I think the studies have shown that the more attention, the better your brand gets remembered over the longer term. So there is value in it. I think the other part of this debate is what the impact of creativity is on attention. And curiously, it isn't the creative that drives the amount of attention. What creative does most importantly, delivers the increase in effectiveness of sales, essentially, from the amount of attention you get. So you might have a boring ad and a brilliantly creative ad, and they would both achieve the same amount of attention that you would expect for that media channel or format, but the more creative one is likely to then have a disproportionate impact onto sales. So the two absolutely are essential. You need to be in the right place to get good amounts of attention, and then you need great creative in order to get that disproportionate impact on effectiveness.
It really is so important. And I think going back to Mandy, Clay and George in the room last Thursday, we saw loads of brilliant examples of that, right? Just really great work that not only got people's attention, but was then really effective with that attention once they'd gotten it.
The way that John Schoolcraft is and his kind of no-nonsense approach that really came through the session, that kind of translates directly into the advertising. You know, they're very much like straight talking. Everything with their ads is, you know, look at me, the packaging as well. Like it just kind of runs through everything to kind of grab your attention. So I think they've kind of, in terms of, you know, attention is something that we're all talking about now. They've been doing that for a number of years now. And it's just, you know, that is like really at the heart of everything that they do with their comms. And yeah, it's just brilliant. But it's just quite funny because as I say, I've not really heard John Schoolcraft talk before, but it's just quite interesting. He really does just embody that brand.
And you could say the brand embodies him, I think as well, but it probably goes both ways. We said Oatly are our next generation. That's just one of 10 different archetypes, one of 10 different ways to take a challenger stance. Malcolm, can you give us a flavour of some of the others and the broad range of archetypes that brands can take when they're looking to be challenger?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think crucially, the main thing that we use to encompass this term of challenger brands isn't necessarily a brand that challenges the market leader. It's not challenging someone, it's challenging something. So that thing doesn't have to be a competitor. And it also means that the brand that's doing the challenging doesn't have to be small or new. They can be the market leader, they can be the oldest brand in the category, they can be new, but they have a defined idea of what they are challenging. And of course, in challenging something, it means that there are accepted behaviors or attitudes in the category that they're choosing to go against. And so when we look at those 10 typologies, they're all examples of a way of going against category convention. So you might have, for example, The Real and Human, which is a brand that is calling out the facelessness of a certain category and trying to put a real person behind a brand. Or you might have The Irreverent Maverick, that's just bored with the category being boring and just wants to shake it up a bit with some humour. Or you might have a dramatic disruptor that uses all of their powers to stir up conversation, often with their product being put centre stage as the hero of all the drama created. So there's numerous ones of them. But yes, as I said, they all have that thing in common, which they are trying to change something that they don't believe in. And if I might go on further, just coming back to a point Mandy made, that when it comes to Oatly, John Schoolcraft said when we were writing the book that he wants to give people a thought that they can think about as they walk down the street. And so, yes, they get the attention and whatever attentive seconds you might get from a brief exposure to an out-of-home ad, but it stays with them. Because you're thinking, you know, milk, it's like milk but made for humans, or their other kind of terminology, which is the cow is no longer needed in the manufacturing of a milk drink, or milk is made for baby cows. You know, these things, they stay with you long after. And I think all of the challenger brands and typologies that we've got want something to stay with you, to stay behind, and to be sure that we are, you know, still thinking about them after we've witnessed them.
One of the slides in the session sort of built on this thought, talking about how become part of popular conversation and popular culture. How do you get your brand and what you stand for mentioned into popular conversation and popular culture? So that post-milk generation, how can people start talking about that? And I think that's something that Oatly and the challenger brands does really well.
And that sense of social amplification is what a lot of these great brands do, right, George?
Yeah, I was just going to pick up on Oatly as being described as a next generation archetype, because I think especially one of the themes that came across through the morning was in the context of purpose being such a driving force at Cannes, and how more and more brands are being following purpose-led strategies. And I think with that in mind, it gave a lot more airtime to the idea of this kind of punk attitude that John Schoolcraft champions, because maybe everyone will then move in that direction to start doing more and more of that and being more like Oatly. And you can only ever be the purpose won't last forever is the sort of the defining strategy.
Just to jump in on that, purpose is that phrase that has created a lot of debate of late. And I think challenger brands, can often be confused as purposeful brands. The 10 types that we've got, one of them is dedicated to that kind of social purpose, and that's the missionary brand. And what we've always said, though, with it is that it can't be just a marketing add-on. It needs to be deeply rooted, like Tony's Chocolonely in the book, where the purpose starts with the product itself and it infiltrates the entire company culture. And then, only then, it comes out into marketing and communications. So I think, purpose can be very powerful for the reasons we know emotion works well in advertising, but it can't be corrupt. It has to be genuine, true. But challenger brands aren't just purposeful brands. Challenger brands are ones that really are fired up by something, but that doesn't necessarily have to be some kind of social or moral purpose. It can be the fact that they just hate the way colours look in a certain category and they want to do something different, or some other thing that they want to rail against, but they are so clear on what that challenge is and what they stand for.
Yeah, Malcolm, I really agree. And it reminds me of going back to Andy Nan's talk. He described humour as brilliantly talking about purpose as well. And you can use humour to talk about purpose. And he used the example of pot noodles in a really sort of funny way. I think you might think that there's limited capacity for pot noodle to talk about purpose, but they really sort of achieved that, and they flipped it really well.
This has been such a refreshing conversation on how to do marketing differently, and hopefully we've gotten listeners excited as well. So Malcolm, for anyone that wants to start applying the principles of challenger brands, to their own brands, but also individuals, what are some practical ways they can go about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff that we can share on this. I mean, principally, the first stop would be there's a website, which is overthrow2.com. That's two, the number two, so overthrow2.com. And you can start to look there just by answering a few simple questions to find out what challenger type the brand that you look after might be, or even you as an individual. So it turns out I'm an enlightened zagger. I know Chris is a dramatic disruptor, but you can find out your own personal challenger type, and also do it for any brand that you have involvement in. And you can, of course, also buy the book from the same website. Shameless plug, but well worth it if you want to find out lots more about challenger thinking and how it can create that disproportionate chain of events leading to disproportionate share of market.
And as Malcolm said, if you want to learn more about challenger thinking and discover your own archetype, head to overthrow2.com with the number two. That's overthrow2.com. That has been the Media Weekly for this week. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week for more.